And as NATO scales down its involvement in Afghanistan, what lessons can be learned from the Soviets' withdrawal back in 1989? Joining us is Nicholas Vozdev, who's professor of national security studies at the U.S. Naval War College. Nicholas, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First of all, it seems to me that there are pretty important differences between how the Russians went into Afghanistan and how quickly and really almost desperately they came out in 1989. Can you run over those for us?
Sure. It's important to know that the Soviets went in to back a coup within the communist government in Afghanistan. They immediately got embroiled in an insurgency that was already fighting the existing communist-backed regime. Then they attempted to do massive social engineering to try to, in the first years, remake Afghanistan as a Soviet-style republic, which provoked a great deal of opposition. They went in, of course, with a great deal of condemnation from the international community. It was one of the few things on which China, Pakistan, and the United States could all agree, that they did not support the Soviet incursion. And, of course, very different than the circumstances of the United States in 2001. We went in with the blessing of the United Nations, with much of the support of the international community, to deal with a terrorist threat which had not only struck the United States, but was seen as threatening most of the governments of the world.
Would you say that modernism was imposed on Afghanistan and that was the problem? It was perceived to be an almost colonial impulse, or it just had nothing to do with the way people actually were going to live in Afghanistan, even in the 20th, 21st century?
Well, part of the problem is that there is a real divide in Afghanistan between the urban centers and the rural countryside, and this has always been a feature of Afghan history in the 20th century. In the 1950s and 1960s, had a very urban and cosmopolitan scene in Kabul, and then you would just go a few miles out, and it was as if you were still in the Middle Ages. And this was an issue for every government in Kabul. What the Soviets attempted to do was to take the mores of the city and then to try to impose them by force on the countryside, which is what produced the Mujahideen and the resistance so strongly against the Soviet system. And of course, the Soviets were also willing to use brute force in a way that the United States has never been. They were willing to kill large numbers of people, to uproot hundreds of thousands of people, to take an active role in persecuting religion in the first years of the occupation. And so that just engendered further resistance. But there is this issue of a divide between the city and the countryside in Afghanistan, where the countryside tends to run its own affairs, does not want much interference from the city, does not want much interference from a central government. There's always been this resistance to central control, and usually these different factions come together and find a way to resist Kabul's directives.
And what would you say are the most persistent features and institutions of governing in Afghanistan, now looking from the Soviet period straight through to this NATO and U.S. occupation?
What the Soviets attempted to do by the end of the 1980s as they were preparing to withdraw was that they dropped much of the ideological blueprint that they had brought with them to create a Soviet-style republic, and they were very willing towards the end, and they were encouraging the government that they were setting up to take control of Afghanistan after they left to reach accommodations with local leaders, to embrace Islam. The Soviet-backed government in 1990, in fact, even declared Afghanistan to be an Islamic republic. So you had the spectacle of a formerly Communist Party chieftain speaking to the National Assembly about how Afghanistan would be an Islamic state. So you did have these efforts to try to reconcile the central government with these local conditions. One of the features which actually served the post-Soviet occupation government very well was to reach out to local military commanders, essentially make them officers in the Central Afghan Army, but essentially allowing them to keep their tribal militias and just simply integrating them into an Afghan fighting force. And as long as those alliances held, the central government in Afghanistan stayed intact, really, until 1992, when it was the defection of those commanders from the government of Najibullah, which ultimately led to the collapse of the Soviet-backed government in March of 92.
And we should note the use of those local commanders in local connections to the central government is precisely the innovation that NATO has used with great effect in broad areas of Afghanistan in this post invasion withdrawal period between U.S., NATO, and British forces.
That's correct. It's a way of relearning some of the lessons that the Soviets themselves went through. When you are contemplating an end to your own active military involvement and you wish to leave something behind that you have a certain degree of confidence will still be there after you depart.
Nicholas Gvozdev, professor of national security studies at the U.S. Naval War College. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway. Stay with us.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.